KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today, I'm very excited to have on the show a return guest, Professor Tim Wu of Columbia University School of Law, author of the new book, The Master Switch: The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Tim's previous work, Who Controls the Internet, was a great exploration of the questions of who ultimately and what entities can possibly regulate internet traffic and the internet itself. In The Master Switch, Tim takes a broader view looking at various, to use the term loosely, monopolies that have existed over time that in one form or another have controlled information and what we could learn from those behaviors. The reference to The Master Switch is something that we will get into in our discussion, but Tim's book canvasses this history in the United States going back, you know, at least 100 years, and ultimately proposes what is a very challenging and thought-provoking new way to ultimately regulate and decide how information is going to flow through the internet and more broadly and less esoterically to people all over the globe. Tim writes, and we'll start our discussion in a moment. Tim writes towards the end of his book, "The simple fact is that the internet is simply not the infinitely elastic phantasm that it is popularly imagined to be, but rather an actual physical entity that can be warped or broken. For while the network is designed to connect every user with every other on an equal footing, it has always depended on a finite number of physical connections, whether wired or spectral, and switches operated by a finite number of firms upon whose good behavior the whole thing depends." A topic on Hearsay Culture over the last year at least has been internet regulation, and we've had a variety of people on, including most recently Laura DeNardis from Yale, who wrote a very fascinating book regarding internet protocol. But today we're going to take a broader look and see what we can learn from this history that Tim writes about both very readably and very thoroughly in his book and get to ultimately, hopefully, a discussion towards the end of Tim's policy proposals. Again, Tim is a prolific author and a professor at Columbia University School of Law. Without any further ado, let's turn to Tim. Tim, thank you for joining us today by Skype from New York. Thank you for taking the time here today.
Sure, thanks.
Let's start right off, Tim, with a question. I know I asked you the last time you were on Hearsay Culture, and I appreciate you coming back. Talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in this topic.
Well, this if you mean the topic of internet regulation at all,
yes,
I became interested in it because I worked in Silicon Valley for a few years, and was also a native computer geek. And so I've always sort of been interested in the question of essentially private control of speech or private information industries. I got, first from working on them, and second from seeing the influence they have on our lives. I also, in law school, was very interested in the First Amendment, like any law student. And so I guess it's always been a natural intersection.
The reference to the master switch is something we're going to get to in a moment, but I think to lead into that discussion, what ultimately impelled you to write this book now?
Well, I felt that there was obviously a lot of interest right now in trying to understand our times, trying to understand what the internet revolution has really meant, trying to understand fundamentally whether the time, what we've all experienced, which I think has been an extraordinary experience for people who have been close to the internet or working in a startup or even just users, and to try and get a set. But it seemed to me that to understand this better, the way to understand it would be to see whether things like this had happened before. In other words, to try and to use an academic phrase, to contextualize the internet experience through a broader history of American inventions of new media and ask whether, in fact, there had been other times like ours and to see what had happened in those other times.
The book, as I mentioned, has quite a bit of history in it. Do you, in terms of what you're going for broadly, I mean, do you see the book as a work of history primarily, or of technology policy, or a mix? I don't mean to paint you into a box, but I'm curious to see how you conceive it.
It's not a work of academic history in the sense that it's not. Well, with some exceptions, it's not based on primary source material. So this is a very academic point, but academic historians are in the business of finding something new that's never been found before. And I did a little bit of that, but I can't. Most of it is based on me reading actually historians' work and learning from them. No, it's a book. The reason I use history is I'm interested in understanding the longer and deeper patterns in these industries. I think that it's rare in the business world. In the political world, it's very common to people in political science and people interested in politics to be continually looking at history and try to, even if it's midterms, after a president wins, they'll lose the midterm, try to look for these repeated patterns. It seems to me as being very rare in the business world and in understanding private industry. And so that was the idea of it. So I don't know if that situates it exactly, but I hope it gets a sense.
Well, it does, and I think it's something I want to talk about a bit later, which is the intersection of law and business writing, which we explore on Hearsay Culture, and that I think you clearly explore here and get your thoughts on it. So in order to get into the book in a little more detail, I'll ask you the obvious first question. What is the master switch?
What is the master switch? The master switch, the phrase comes from a quote from Fred Friendly, who used to be the president of CBS News, and he's famous for he's actually played by George Clooney in a movie, Good Night and Good Luck. And he was president of CBS News, and he was this famous media writer, very critical of the networks, which he was part of. And he wrote in one of his articles, he said, and he was talking about the media markets, he was saying, "At stake is not the First Amendment or the right of free speech, but exclusive custody of the master switch." This implied that there was a level of control beyond our somewhat superficial discussion of free speech or the First Amendment. There was a level below that at which the decisions were really being made, and that was the level of the master switch. And at some level, that's the theme of this book, is it is encouraging the reader to look below the sort of superficial debates over things like public censorship, and into the deeper question of who is actually controlling what information reaches people.
The focus of the master switch itself, I think, leads back to a question I did want to ask you about your evolution as a thinker on cyber law and technology more broadly. Towards the beginning of your book, you talk about your own progression from what I will call, and this was true of many people, thinking about technology policy, certainly in the 90s, as perhaps a utopian, but certainly one that was looking at the infinite possibilities of the new information architecture that we have, and to perhaps a more granular view today. And again, perhaps you could talk a bit about your evolution in thinking from perhaps 15 years ago to now in terms of what the internet is.
Yeah, it's certainly gone through cycles. In fact, I would say it's a little different, that I've gone from being something more of a cynic to something more of utopian, and then somewhat back to a cynic again. I've gone through a multiple stage process, and I think that there's a certain naturalness to that. It depends on what other people are saying, how reactive or how supportive you are. I think that this book basically represents where I am. The book is, in some ways, a mediation. At its deepest level, the book is a mediation on the deepest questions of monopoly in American life. And it's a more honest grappling with the fact that while we decry and dislike the idea of monopoly power and control, we, and even myself, sometimes also kind of love it. And so it's a struggle with that problem, is that relationship to centralized power and to the great information companies, whether it was AT&T in the 1910s or Google or Apple today, which I think a lot of us feel, is that we feel this unease that so much power should be in a single entity, but also feel that their products are fabulous. The book, in a sense, is I think my best representation of my grappling with that internal dilemma.
Yeah, and go ahead. No, please.
No, at a deeper level, it's my grappling with what it means to be American in a way. Even though I'm American, I was raised in Canada, so I'm also Canadian, and you know we have this sort of taste for the monarchy, to be honest. And you know it's not very obviously Americans are raised to the idea of a monarchy is wrong, but then they have that same we have Americans have the same tendency to worship power, to worship the great leader. And to sort of yearn for a great and benevolent power to take care of everything. And this book is a grappling, I mean, at the deeper levels, a grappling with that challenge. And that sort of explains my back and forth, I think, between the issues, is I have mixed feelings about many of the things that I write about in my book.
Are there particular events as you think of and what I think you described as perhaps you know two big changes from cynic to utopian and from utopian perhaps back to something more concerned and I'll use your word cynic. Were there events in those two changes that caused you to change your thinkings? Is there anything you can point to that caused the changes?
Yeah, sort of my own intellectual history.
Yes. We do. We have 50 minutes, so yeah, I get into some of these things.
That's an interesting question. I think if I can think of one thing, I think I had more faith in the private industry before I went to work in the private industry. So in other words, I think I had – I don't hate the private industry. I just decided when I was there that they are human. And we had learned in school somehow that there was this sort of magic to the market that you let the market solve things. This was a very popular idea in the 90s. The market sort of had this deeper wisdom than people. And when I was in the private industry, I felt like, well, these guys are extremely human and if anything are often – less aware of what's going on than people in government. I don't think government should make decisions either. It just occurred to me that anyone making decision is very error prone, and so I think that had a large influence on me.
Mm-hmm.
The experience of Washington. I spent a lot more time in policy over the last couple of years, and I wasn't in Washington, but I've been much more involved. That has had an experience too. It's made me oddly think that. To believe that even despite the fact that industry is not always so great, that the first line of defense in some way is always going to be industry virtue or self-regulation. That is to say, it made me think that the real problem, I believe in government oversight, but I think the most important step is virtue in leaders in positions of great power. In the private industry, which in our industry is in private industry, because the public people aren't in the same capacity. And I think that had an effect on me too. I don't know if those make sense. I hadn't thought about this carefully before, but those are just some thoughts I had.
No, I mean I think it does, and it perhaps ties in. I wanted to ask you about this as part of the beginning of our discussion. You know, you are the chairman of Free Press, and
right.
For listeners that aren't familiar with Free Press, perhaps I'll ask you about Free Press because it occurred to me as you're answering this question that certainly your efforts with Free Press perhaps fit into the view that you're expressing today. But perhaps you can tell listeners about Free Press and if you
sure.
think there's a connection.
Free Press is one of America's largest media reform organizations, and it has a wing in Massachusetts and a wing in D.C., and it basically keeps pressure on it got started opposing media media mergers or other types of combinations, removal of the rules that would – ownership rules. And has since then been very involved in net neutrality debate, and particularly putting public pressure on government institutions. So that's Free Press. What I think is it's a lot easier for government to do its job if people in private industry feel a sense of public duty. That's what I've learned, particularly from this history and also working there. That is to say, I think it's important that companies in vitally important industries, whether it's information industries or finance or anything where they have a huge effect on the public, that they have a sense of their own duties to the public as opposed to simply their shareholders. That is the most important starting point. Because it's one thing for a regulator to try to tell someone what to do. It's another thing to tell them to do something they already feel they should be doing. So I think that's incredibly important. The culture of leadership and public duty in the private sector has, over time, come to me as being the most important thing. You know, even if you yell at people, tell them what to do, if they want to do it in the first place, it's always a lot easier.
And certainly, I mean, this is obviously a timely issue, and, you know, we're recording this show on November 8th, and in fact, this is a show that's going to air in just a couple of days on Wednesday, and we're sitting here a week after some pretty cataclysmic changes in Washington that perhaps have been precipitated by the excesses of private industry, particularly finance, which leads us to, I think, to a further discussion of the subtitle of your book before we get into more detail. You know, you refer to in your subtitle to the rise and fall of information empires, which to me implies that merger of private and public interests. What is an information empire in how you define it?
Well, first of all, it's a nice term for a cover of a book.
right. And it fits in with a very stark cover.
It does have a meaning. There is an imperial character to the firms that I study in the book. And one of the things I do in the book is I guess I study business history like political history. I study business history like political history, and Dave, are we able to pause? I'm sorry. Is this a student tape?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Hold on. Go ahead. Okay, so we're back with Tim Wu.
Yeah, you were asking about why we talk about the rise and fall of information empires. The firms I study in this book have an imperial aspect. And one thing I want to say about my methodology in this book is I study firms and business history the way most people study political history, and I study their conflict the way people write about war. industrial conflict the way people write about war. So it's a slightly different approach. And when I say they have an imperial character, what I mean by that is typically they are not, as an economist would suggest, primarily interested in profit or money. These firms are interested in power and size and domination, and those are their instincts. They're much more Roman in their nature, or imperial, I guess, is no better word. So I don't think a firm is kind of a misdescription of a firm or a company that's interested more in control than it is in profit.
We're chatting with Tim Wu of Columbia University, author of the book The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Tim, how did you pick the – I mean, you focus heavily on AT&T, but certainly that's not the only monopoly that you focus on. How did you pick the monopolies that you discuss in the book? Were there particular factors or elements that you were looking to find in your discussion?
It wasn't hard at all. I just chose the most obvious ones. There's a story in the 20th century, which is basically the story of film, the telephone, and the motion pictures, all of which were new media. No one knew what they were going to be or what they were going to become. In some ways, they were interchangeable. There were times when people thought the telephone network would be used for broadcasting and the radio would be used for telephony. In some ways, we've transformed it ourselves since we use mobile phones, which are radio. They were obvious. AT&T was in charge of American telephone for 70 years. It's not a hard thing to miss. Broadcasting chains were in charge of radio and then television for 50 years. And the Hollywood studios took charge in the 20s, 30s, still to some degree are in charge of film in America. So it's very obvious. In more modern times, it was a bit more challenging because obviously you don't know what company is going to last. For all we know, Google will be gone in 5 years, or maybe it'll be here for 50 years. So that's a bit more of a choice. But I chose the obvious ones. One that's missing is Microsoft, and partially it's you can't write about everyone, but In a longer book, I might have written about Microsoft also.
Well, I am curious about that because to press on that a little bit, what distinguishes Microsoft from the other monopolies that you focused on such that it didn't make the cut, as it were?
Nothing really. It was just limitations of size. I think Microsoft fits the narrative very cleanly, and trying to understand what happened to Microsoft, why it started to lose position, would be a really powerful addition to the book. I just didn't do it. The AOL Time Warner story was also much, which I sort of tell in the same time period, is a neater story. So that's it. There's chapters I left out of this book. There was a long section on PBS and NPR that I left out. I did originally at one point have some Microsoft stuff. It's less to do with any coherent theory and more to do with trying to put together a book that works as a package.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Well, perhaps I'll towards the end of the discussion, I'll ask you a little bit about the I guess it would be the director's cut of the master switch with regard to NPR and PBS. You're well known for espousing core values of the internet of open and free architecture and so forth. Perhaps I'll ask you again for readers and listeners that may not be as familiar. If you describe your general conception of the core values of the internet, what would they be?
Oh, that's very interesting. The core value of the internet is its resistance to integration. It's layered nature. Its tendency to cut a line between the movement of information and the information itself or the applications on top of it. So I think that is the absolute fundamental thing about it and what, in some sense, made it revolutionary. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how that happened, how the internet was born. And I think one of the most interesting things is to notice how in some ways it was more accidental than you might have thought, or anyone might have thought. I mean, there's a lot of stories about it being defense-funded research, and that's all true, packet switching. But one of the things that was so interesting is that the founders of the internet weren't particularly powerful. So they had to build something that connected networks over which they didn't control. It's a network of networks. And in that process, they had to build a sort of what you would call a federal structure. That is to say, a structure where each of the members of the internet had some autonomy. And that structure is what makes it different. Every other network in history had been centralized, controlled by a single master, and this who owned the network from the top to the bottom, or as much as they could. This network was, by design, a network that linked other people, and so therefore gave power to the ends.
Do you think, and again, this is not quite a crystal ball question, but based upon your understanding and interviewing people like Vint Cerf and others that are credited with having founded the internet as we know it today, do you think that these founders, these original architects of the internet, envisioned the kinds of monopoly power that you describe in the book?
I think there was more monopoly power at the time than there is now when they were designing it. So they were familiar. They lived in the world of IBM and AT&T. By the way, IBM is the other company that's not in the book.
Ah.
That would be in another version of the book. Yeah.
There we go.
They lived in the time of IBM and AT&T. So I think they were very familiar with this idea and in some sense were very resistant to it. At a deep level, what you see encoded in the internet structure, I don't even know if it's conscious or unconscious, because people are some of the values of the 70s, which were a beginning of a resistance to huge centralized systems that were running America. When you look at America in the sort of 50s, 60s, you look at a country which had gone from a very decentralized republic with little states and very small federal government and small companies, small businessmen, farmers. That was the United States in the 19th century. By the mid part of the 20th century, we had become a completely different nation where most people worked at giant companies, where you had massive federal agencies running big parts of the country, and where generally everything or most important parts of life were in the charge of large institutions. And the 60s and 70s were a revolt against that. in a lot of ways, in urban design with Jane Jacobs, in economics, as small as beautiful movement, you know, and everything that was going on, music and the rise of rock and roll. And so the internet is part of that. It's part of this revolution against centralized power. And so I think they were very familiar with the idea of monopoly and what they were doing, the founders, not was acting in reaction to AT&T and IBM.
Do you think on a broader level that these same individuals anticipated, or perhaps you'll have the same answer, envisioned the mutuality of interest that often exists between the private and public sector in maintaining some of these monopolies? You talk about that in the context of AT&T and others, but is that something that they saw as well?
I think they took it for granted. I mean, these guys were all funded by the government. So I think, you know, if you had to put yourself back in 1968 and think about doing research, they start by saying, okay, can we get AT&T or can we get the government to do this? There's only two players in communications. There's not, as far as I can tell, much of a – there's a little bit of a private culture, but it's not the VC culture we have today. It's sort of, well, can we convince government or can we convince AT&T to do this? That's what the dialogues look like. It's a completely different environment.
And
I think it was second nature that the government was essential to this stuff.
Which I think ties into another word that you use in the book that I'll ask you to define, which is the cycle. And you refer to a number of cycles in this development. What is the cycle and how does it tie into to these last few give and takes that we've had?
Yeah, sure. So in the book, I describe, as you said, something called the cycle, which is this almost natural progression between the natural progression of events that follows the invention of a new and highly disruptive technology. And they are roughly some effort to destroy that technology. If it survives an open era where of entrepreneurship and opportunity and utopianism, and eventually the closing of that medium or the closing of the industry surrounding the new invention, usually under in the hands of a single strong man. So that is the cycle, and it seems to recur with regularity surrounding new inventions.
And it ties in with, before we take a very short break, it ties in with another phrase you use, the Kronos effect, which has quite a revolting history in how you describe it in the book. But go ahead. Yeah, so what is that and how does it fit in?
So Kronos was, the second ruler of the universe in Greek mythology. And like most rulers, he was nervous about his rule and nervous in particular that one of his children would usurp him. That was prophesied that one of his children would usurp him. And so to prevent that problem, every time a child was born, he would eat the child. And I'm suggesting that many monopolists, many dominant firms, end up a little bit like Cronus. They are quite paranoid about losing power and willing to take measures to prevent that happening that sometimes can get quite extreme. At the height of its powers, AT&T, while still a magnificent firm in many ways, was also somewhat paranoid. The level of the stuff they would block because they thought it might be a threat to the firm, or the things they would deploy extremely slowly to prevent any disruption of their rule. The list is long, includes things like the answering machine, or in fact, just even tape recorders, period. Hmm. Because they thought if you had tape recorders, no one would use telephones anymore. Because someone could be recording you, and that would be terrible. So there is this, I think it's very much human nature, that once you're in charge, at some point you start trying to stay in charge, and not everyone eats their children, but they do things that sometimes are similar.
You're listening to Hearsay Culture, KZSU FM Stanford, and Professor Tim Wu of Columbia University Law School, author of the book The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. KZSU.stanford.edu, or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the station. With regard to, Tim, with regard to the cycle and the Cronus effect, is it fair to say in your view that this effect or these principles apply to all information empires, or are there forms of information empires you envision that would not have the impetus to use this blunt and like I said, revolting phrase, eat their own?
Now, that's a very interesting question. I thought you were going to say something different, which are there information empires that are more and less tolerable?
Well, that was going to be a follow-up as well. So,
yeah.
So
whether there are information empires that don't, that's an extremely interesting question. It would depend on, you would require a very different kind of corporate leader. To tell you the truth, what you would require for that to work is something we've never heard of in business, which is term limits for monopolists. In other words, you'd have to have a culture whereby a business in charge for a certain period of time, let's say Facebook, 10 years, they say, you know what, this has been great, let's let someone else run this. Which, you've never heard of. Even sometimes the CEO will step down, but the actual firm just saying, let's just, or give this industry, or hand over our protocols to the public and like call it a day.
Mm-hmm.
That you'd require that kind of culture, which we sometimes have in other parts of life. There are people who do sometimes gracefully exit, but it's very rare in the business world, the jungle. For it's more like the a pack of wolves, where the junior wolf has to kill the senior wolf to see any change. We rarely see people sort of gracefully retire. It's possible, and maybe in some ways, what I'm hoping is that we should think about ways of gracefully of industries or companies trying to retire a little more gracefully, or maybe they can change better. I'm not sure, but it's definitely human nature to try and hold on to power.
Before you move, because I do want to ask you what empires are more or less prone to in a moment, but you, since you've raised this point, I think a logical follow-up is, does the market serve that role? In other words, does the market, and by that I mean consumers generally, ultimately impose term limits as fads come and go and as products are improved and designed, or are we talking about something different?
No, it does. It can. It can. The term limits imposed by... But there are term limits in the sense that African dictators have term limits, right? Someone else shows up and kills the dictator. That's the term limit. So it's and how long? So in other words, they're unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that sometimes a firm can manage to insulate itself from competition so effectively that the market can no longer displace it.
So I think I hear you saying, therefore, that there are no information empires as currently are constituted that wouldn't be prone to the cycle and the Cronus effect. Am I correct?
Yeah, I guess I'm saying that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so
it depends. I don't want to be absolute and say every monopolist lasts forever, because obviously they do get taken down by the market. It isn't there is a limit. I'm just saying it's extremely unpredictable how mm-hmm. long a monopolist can end. And let me add to it: if they manage to get the federal government on their side,
right.
This is a particularly important point. This is a mistake that that economist Joseph Schumpeter made when he, and many market people make, pro-market people. I'm not anti-market, but I'm saying you cannot expect the market to displace a firm when it has the protection of the federal government. And firms that get powerful enough, one way or another, usually find some way to use government power to protect themselves. And once that happens, it's extremely hard, as I've said, to expect the new startup to come along and beat them out, because they need to convince the government to let them do that, and then you're talking about a whole different ballgame.
And that's something I want to turn to in a moment, because I focus heavily on, particularly in trade secrecy, as you know, on how government and private industry seem to be working hand in glove in ways that ultimately impact transparency and accountability, but more broadly the role of government. But the follow-up question, which you mentioned, I do want to get us to. So if there aren't any information empires that wouldn't be prone to these effects, as you mentioned, there are some that might be more or less prone. So perhaps you give me the example of the entity that would be most prone to it, and perhaps the one that's least likely to be susceptible.
Can you say that again? Sorry.
Yeah, sure. Which information empires, if you can categorize them, would be most susceptible to the cycle and the Cronus effect versus the least?
Yeah, which of them are most likely? I think that it's hard to say as a general. You mean of our current one, the ones that are around today?
Of the ones that are around today, and particularly of the ones that you focused on in the book.
Okay, well, you have to ask, well, who actually has the help of government? And one thing I want to suggest is that it's still the AT&T companies, and you know, they're not all bad, but they definitely have the closest relationship to government. The old telecom firms and the old broadcasters still have the closest relationship to government. And spectrum is still used, control over the airwaves is still used as a way to control competition in those areas. And so it's easiest for those firms to try and prevent competition. The Silicon Valley firms are less, you know, are by their nature further from federal help. And they're a very interesting and different story. And I think we're still going to see how they do. We're very early, and you know, we don't know. Someone 50 years from now is going to be able to tell me what Google did to stay in charge or didn't.
Right.
It's going to take someone 50 years from now because we're too early in the Silicon Valley monopoly phase.
We're talking with Tim Wu of Columbia University, author of the book The Master Switch on KJSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Tim, let's drill down on this government-industry partnership. I mean, there's a growing body of literature that focuses on public-private partnerships and how they ultimately both benefit government and private industry, but perhaps, and certainly my concern, is that they distort the roles of both. Should we be concerned, and I mentioned this earlier, that private industry and government could have so much interest and mutual value interest that the solutions that we'll talk about in a moment, but the problems themselves become exacerbated. How closely are government and industry aligned today as you see it?
Yeah, it's a very good question. You know, it's definitely not like it was 50 years ago, 50 or 60 years ago, to the credit of the government, frankly. 50 years ago, AT&T had a major role not only in running the telephone system, but also a major role in national defense.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the reasons that the federal government antitrust department didn't break them up. The Defense Department was strongly opposed to breaking up AT&T. So I don't think we're anywhere close to where we were 50 or 60 years ago. In my book, the nadir of American, of some of the values I treasure, is in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, freedom and decentralization and smallness are at an nadir. So we're nowhere near that situation. And you know, the closest comes to spectrum issues. But and generally, I think it's a lot better. I maybe you were looking for another kind of answer, but I think it's a lot better than it was. And I think people are a little bit more wary in government now of there being too much of a union of interest. Nonetheless, that being said, there is ultimately a very close relationship between the big telecom firms, the big broadcasters, and the FCC, and they're very close. You know, they're supposed to be disciplining them, but they are close. So let's put it that way. But they're not an arm of government the way we talked about 50 years ago. And if I could just make final note on that. I mean, it does change the nature of government. We have to be really honest about what kind of government we have, and when you have the largest monopolies and government working together, it's really a different form of government. It's what's called corporatism. If you take it to more extremes, it's called fascism. And I think we have to be aware that even though the labels aren't there, and it's that this kind of thing can happen in America.
You know, I focus in my own writing on how the use of trade secrecy by governments and entities that provide public infrastructure not only changes the nature of IP law, but also changes their role. And so I share that concern, although I think your point is well taken that if we refer to the military-industrial complex of 50 years ago, we could certainly have a challenge as to which had a closer mutuality of interest. But that's an academic discussion we can move on from, because I do want to ask you about net neutrality. An area, of course, where a term that you are credited with coining, but also an area in which you've been involved. Putting the issues of FCC regulation aside for a moment, what's your view of the net neutrality debate as it exists today? Has this value been misused or mutated in recent debates?
you know, everyone uses the phrase the way they want, but no, I still think it's a very valuable phrase because the importance, I've always said that the most important thing in these debates is public pressure. And I think there is a norm that has evolved over the last 10 years that more or less you shouldn't mess with net neutrality. That if you do, you will face a reaction from people. And it's very easy to label. You know, 20 years ago, this kind of thing would happen all the time. Or, I mean, without the phrase net neutrality, I think that things would happen that we wouldn't realize were happening. And now there's a, you can say, well, look, that violates net neutrality. And then there's a discussion and there's a, people leap back like they're stunned. You know, over the summer, the New York Times broke that story over Google Verizon, making a deal that was in violation of net neutrality. And, you know, Google said, no, we didn't. And Verizon said, no, we didn't. And there was like a big denial and back and forth. But the point was, nobody was out there saying, yes, we are violating net neutrality. We don't give a damn. If that's, can I say that on this show?
I think you'll get by.
Yeah. Nobody said, you know, we don't care. And that's important. I think having net neutrality as a kind of a third rail, that is, you mess with it and it's something that you can be criticized about, is the most important function. The details of what it stands for, things like that, are quite confusing and muddling, I have to agree. But having it out there as a, this is wrong to mess with, is the most important function of the phrase.
Are you, before we get to your solutions in the last 10 or so minutes that we have, are you concerned about the survival of net neutrality as a focus of our debate based upon last week's election results?
Oh, yeah. Not necessarily. The FCC still has an enormous amount of power. It's not currently choosing to use that power. But no, I'm not that worried. And also, I've also become convinced of the fact that the wiretapping laws are also net neutrality laws. I hadn't realized this. A scholar named Paul Ohm at Colorado pointed this out to me, which is most of the techniques that would violate net neutrality, DPACT inspection, happen to be violations of the federal wiretapping laws. So I've recently become convinced that we actually have a federal net neutrality regime already in place. We just, it has to be a little more, we have to start to realize that. This professor just noticed that any of the techniques you would need to discriminate in terms of DPACT inspection and so forth are violations of the wiretapping statute. So the wiretapping statute may have be an accidental net neutrality law that we didn't realize. So no, I'm not really worried about the elections. And you know, the Congress, they were never going to pass a net neutrality law anyways, even under the Democrats, and they won't do one under the Republicans. So it's sort of irrelevant. The question is what the FCC decides to do.
Right. And do you have any thoughts on what the FCC is going to decide to do?
I do. I won't.
You won't discuss them here.
I'll let them have their own thunder.
Fair enough.
Because I don't want to blow. Yeah, but they have a plan.
Fair enough. Paul Ohm, by the way, was on the show about a year or so ago discussing.
May I say, Paul Ohm is a genius.
I agree.
Paul Ohm is the next generation of internet scholar. He is he's at the top of his game.
Well, I certainly enjoyed having him on the show, and I've been a fan of his work. So that will remind me to invite Paul back on. By the way, offline, perhaps I'll take other suggestions from you for people I should chat with. In the remaining about 7 or so minutes that we have, Tim, and I know that you're on a tight schedule. Let's talk about the solution that you propose to these problems. I mean, you focus heavily on AT&T and this monopoly power, and we've discussed what the master switch looks like. Your solution is what you call the separate. Separations principle, and what is that?
Yeah, separations principle suggests what I learned from studying the history in my book is that the real problems come, the most serious problems come from integration of separate functions in the information industries. In particular, integration of ownership of content and integration of transport. Those in particular. And so I say that what we need to install or have in place as a norm where we as Americans demand separations between the major functions in the information industries. That sounds kind of technical, but a fundamental separation between transport and content is important for a nation that lives and breathes information. And, I propose it not so much as regulation, but as a deeper kind of principle like separation of church and state, or separation of news and editorial. I want us to recognize that there are some inherent conflicts of interest involved in being the carrier of information and the owner of that information.
And so this principle has, as you know, garnered some criticism from libertarians or technological libertarians at places like the Technology Liberation Front, who say that this is and I'm summarizing their critique as big government. Do you have any general response to that criticism? Is what you're proposing a big government, quote unquote, solution to the issues that you raise?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's a sort of boilerplate critique for something a libertarian doesn't like. You know, is the church and state separation big government because the governments are telling church and state to stay separate? Kind of, but it's a little more complicated than that, right? You know, I'm talking about a principle, not a regulatory regime or not the New Deal. And so I think that criticism misunderstands the point. I am calling for a sensitivity, and I think it's actually somewhat there among members of the public as to the dangers that arise from being the person who carries information around, being in a very close identity, or being the exact same person who creates information or controls it. And so that's all I'm trying to say. Now, I think the government should oversee and try to prevent some of the mergers that might involve, and maybe that's where the idea comes of it being too big government. But I think it's a more fundamental issue. It's a free speech issue, and if you want to call the First Amendment big government, go ahead.
And yeah, not to dwell on it, the Technology Liberation Front has a detailed analysis of your book with complimentary remarks as well, as well as some criticisms that are an interesting counterpoint to some of the issues you raised.
Yeah, can I say a little bit? I have a friend, and he wrote the criticism, and I'm actually strangely enough, although I have a lot of libertarian enemies, I consider myself a person who is deeply libertarian. I just think the barriers to freedom in our lives are a lot different than mainstream libertarianism. Mainstream libertarianism, I guess if there is such a thing, is obsessed with government. And, you know, I can see that. I think Soviet Union was a bad place, and Nazi Germany, I am no fan of totalitarian systems. But for some reason, in my opinion, they've had a great blind spot to the inhibitions on liberty created by private sources. You know, if censorship is practiced by government or practiced by Walmart, it still affects the viewer the same way, right? I mean, in terms of limitation of your freedom, if it's a private or public source, its effect is the same. Now, how you change it might be different. One is elections, the other is you don't buy the product or something, or try and boycott it. But the effect is the same. And so something I've never understood about the libertarian movement is its blind spot to private power, and also blind spot sometimes to social norms, which can also be incredibly hindering. A code against, let's say, being gay or something. I mean, the norm can be so much worse than any law. I don't know why they aren't interested in real freedom. Sorry, that's a little harsh. I think they are interested in real freedom, but I think there's blinders in the libertarian movement.
Wait, I've been meaning to invite some people from TLF on the show, and I think perhaps you've thrown down the gauntlet, Tim, where I'll have them on and see what they have to say. But I mean that critique is certainly one that we hear. And again, you know, it focuses on what has become a fundamental mutation in what private industry is doing today when they're selling voting machines to governments and so forth.
I'm deeply interested in what it means to be free, deeply.
Yeah, yeah.
And in such a way that I'm not interested in things like government, private industry. I'm just interested in freedom. Sorry, I'm sounding like a crazy person, but and if you're interested in that, I think it's crazy to start having, you know, to be discriminatory as to what is enslaving you, because you just care about freedom. You don't care who made the bars, government, industry, or society. It's still a prison.
No, I certainly agree with you, which leads to a follow-up point, which is, of course, the values inherent in these entities, because private industry clearly has many different operating principles than government does. First-year business associations course, my professor drilled into our heads that the only responsibility a corporation has is to its shareholders. And while we could use some facile analogies and say, well, the government's responsibility is to the citizens, when we get to a slightly deeper level of granularity, those comparisons start falling away. As we think about, and this is really the closing question for you, you mentioned this at the beginning. You definitely were concerned that the internet might be in deep trouble in who controls the internet. You raise the specter of the cycle, really, and the master switch, of course, in this piece. As you look out on the horizon now, and I'm not asking you to pull a crystal ball, based upon the data that we have now, what do you see as the biggest threat to the internet, and do you think we'll get to a solution to it?
Yeah, if I had to put it, it is the rise of the greatest threat to an open internet is probably Apple. Just to put it into a single word, why I say that is because Apple is following the pattern that all the other firms did in the history of the information industries, which is they offer incredibly seductively beautiful products, which I use many of myself, that slowly but kind of inevitably change the nature of the underlying medium. And so I would say company Apple, or in the form of Apple, maybe like a union between Apple and Facebook, is the nature in which you will see the fundamental nature of the internet change.
Tim Wu, professor, Columbia University Law School, author of the book The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, Throwing Down the Gauntlet and Identifying Apple as Our Single Biggest Threat to the Internet. I'm kidding around a little bit, Tim. But it's an interesting closing point. Thank you so much for joining us in Hearsay Culture. I appreciate you taking the time, and I look forward to chatting with you again in the future to make you a three-time returning guest.
Okay, great. I look forward to it.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
I'm very excited to mention a number of people that are coming up on the show. Guests that will be rounding out this quarter. Coming up next week, a Professor Adrian Johns of the University of Chicago, author of the book Piracy. Professor Greg Listowka of Rutgers School of Law, Camden, author of the book Virtual Justice. Professor Nick Bostrom, director of the Future of Humanity Institute and professor at the University of Oxford. Sarah Rose, author of the book For All the Tea in China. And then we'll pretty much be closing the quarter at that point, but there are a number of other guests coming up in the winter quarter, which will begin at the end of the year. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You have several options. You can listen to the show by way of podcast, if you choose to go that route, by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page at Center for Internet Society through the iTunes search engine. You can also go to the webpage for the Center for Internet Society at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and you can pick up all of the shows by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get not only the upcoming schedule, but also the guests that have previously been on the show. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, that's dave@hearsayculture.com. And again, I am booking guests into next year at this point. I'll mention the guests that I've already have booked, which will be on the show, most of whom will be on the show in January, February, and into March. Ryan Kahlo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford. Associate Dean Mike Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Evgeny Morozov of Foreign Policy and author of the book How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Web. Professor Siva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, author of the book The Googleization of Everything, forthcoming. Professor Jennifer Urban, a director of the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley. Dan Hunter, a professor at New York Law School. Jamay Cassio, discussing his book Hacking the Earth. Professor Andy Hiley, my colleague at Elon, discussing online sales taxation. Professor Dan Sullivan of George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Professor Ramesh Srinivasan, Director of Information Studies and Design at the Media Arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. And Kevin Paulson of Wired Magazine, author of the book Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over a $1 billion Cyber Crime Underground. So I'm looking forward to all of these guests and more, and also David Post, author of books Jefferson's Moose. I'm looking forward to chatting with all these people, as I am with you, next week on Hearsay Culture. So thank you for joining us today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.